Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Business news, views, and insights from across the globe.
Welcome, everyone, to Hidden Growth Champions, our podcast series. Today, we have a special episode in our series. And in these special episodes, we look at management innovations. We looked at new ways in which management teams apply themselves in and beyond the pandemic, trying new innovations, deciding to work differently, make decisions differently, ultimately have a different impact on the environments. I'm really pleased today to have Adrian Sevel back in our studio. I know, Adrian, we did promise the last time we'll have you back. So it's great that you've given out of your busy schedule to come and speak to us. Welcome. And for those who may have not met you as yet, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thank you, Saul. It's great to be back with you. I'm Adrian Sevel. I'm professor in economics, finance, and strategy at the Gordon Institute of Business Science, where I work in postgraduate programs and executive education. And in the recent past, I've been involved in producing research for a corporate client, which looks at inclusive, sustainable, impactful, I'm trying to think of some other rhyming words or alliterative words, relevant and resilient business models. And I think all of those things belong to the COVID-19 or post-COVID-19, I'm not sure which one we're in, but all of those belong to that that environment. And alongside that, for the last 20 years or so, I've been involved in the investment industry. And a particular facet of that investment industry involvement has been chairing the investment committee of Meta Capital, which is a venture capital investment fund. And if you're going to be finding cutting edge and inclusive businesses that are readying themselves for fast change, I think that's a very good table to be seated at, where the conversations are possibly as fast moving as the businesses themselves.
Now, Adrian, let's start off with if we had to have this conversation 5 years ago versus now, we probably wouldn't all recognize Larry Fink's famous letter to CEOs, which now millions of people read. We would probably be talking to a smaller audience. So when I think about this shift, the attention that's being given to sustainability in its broader sense, to impact investing, to the type of organizations that are involved in what is becoming more of the mainstream, why do you think has shifted?
Well, one aspect, I think that there are push and pull factors. So let me change my one aspect to make it two, that there are push and pull factors. And I think what I mean by the pull factors is that as investors are presented with different evidence, new data, they might be pulled into a changed mindset or a changed perspective. And you know, to this extent, the thing that is pulling them, I think, is the growing body of evidence, not quite universal, but broad recognition that there is at best a weak relationship between what I would call capitalist orthodoxy, a focus or a single-minded attention to shareholder value. There is a weak relationship at best between that capitalist orthodoxy and investment returns and business performance. At best, there is a large body of evidence that oftentimes finds a negative relationship with that narrow single focus on shareholder return capitalist orthodoxy and business performance and investor returns. So I would call that a suite of pull factors that you're being pulled into a different realm or a different reality by a recognition of the importance of health, sustainability, the environment, and we can be really intangible here and talk about, you know, the importance of happiness. I'm reminded of the mountain kingdom of Bhutan, which has replaced gross national product with gross national happiness as the barometer of progress and prosperity. So, you know, there are those factors that I would just refer to as a broad body of evidence that is causing a growing recognition and realization. And then there are factors that we might describe as push factors. And the push factors are the things that are squaring up to investors, businesses, executive teams in their state of existence. You know, I could rudely call this comfort zones. With Michelle Ashen, I've been having some really interesting conversations about being asleep at the wheel, where it's just, you know, the ordinary business of continuing to do what you've been doing for a very long time. It's translated into successful businesses. And these push factors that are saying, you know, we're not okay with this. This is not acceptable. It's not enough. Is a broad suite of social and environmental conditions. You could call this wokeness, but where society at large, and Larry Fink, your point to make it sharper, you know, it has just said, this is not okay. We cannot expect to sustain this way of doing business. And we have to go, and it needs to go beyond just doing well by doing good. You know, it needs to be meaningful. It needs to be real, it needs to be relevant and capture all of those alliterations that I had earlier, inclusive, impactful, and so on. So I think it's that combination, short answer, push and pull factors.
Okay, fantastic. I'm really glad you refer to it as both pull and push, because when I think as to some of the discussions we have with executive teams, you could literally see this playing out. You could have a conversation about value creation and how that pans out within an industry and how industries shift and evolve and change, the ability to create value changes with it. New windows of opportunities open up. Now, what really intrigues me is when you have those discussions and you start to introduce some of those pull factors or some of those push factors, very often people can start to look at their own business with a completely different pair of eyes. Suddenly things that were impossible, not within the realm of possibility, not within the realm of what they could sell to boards or to shareholders, start to become possible. They may be outlying options at first. They may be out there still to be tested, proven, see if we could scale them, can only do with partners, not on our own. But they become possible, and suddenly the aspects of going beyond, as you've said, doing good by doing well, starts to fit into how does the core perform better? And that's more than that one-to-one relationship between shareholder capitalism and therefore the returns that we get. And when that happens, you know, some people become curious upfront and participate, and some only become curious or participate in the process when they start to think of investment decisions. So perhaps a bit of a long introduction into my next question, but if I had to ask you, when you start to think about the kind of investment decisions that executive teams need to make, the kind of big choices that we have to weigh up, you know, I was listening earlier to the Prime Minister of Singapore. He was just on CNN earlier speaking about some of these big choices, national choices sometimes. How do you see those push or pull factors being brought in from what may be not well understood or only understood in a certain context into something that speaks right to the machinery, to the engine of our business? Perhaps you can share an example or two with us of what you've witnessed.
Sure. I think that's a great run-up to, you know, turn some of these concepts into empirical or company case examples. First, my urging would be to get from, you know, thinking about, you know, should I do this? Could I do this? What would happen if I did that? You know, which can be very philosophical and can be well-intentioned, but is clouded by uncertainty or, you know, confused by unknowability. And my opening observation was there is a growing raft of evidence, and that evidence we could call, you know, scientific. And the result of that science, you know, isn't that it suddenly makes you, you know, infinitely wise, but rather it removes the error or removes the repeat of error. And what I mean by that is, if you look at business applications, business conduct, business processes, they can have a win-win through to a lose-lose outcome. And that's, you know, John Nash's game theory type framework. And the best possible outcome is a business that produces a win-win outcome, that the business does better and better, and its customers, the communities that it services, do better and better. I think the tragedy is that through the second half of the 1900s, I was looking for a decade, but let me just be broad and, you know, suggest that through the second half of the 1900s, business models emphasized that, you know, the business of business is business, that it's about the pursuit of performance for shareholders, the owners of the businesses. And I would argue that as a collective, we need to take a very, very big step back from that statement, because business only exists because it is serving some purpose for a community or a country or a society at large. The purpose of business is not to produce profit. An outcome of a business doing good, I would change that definition, an outcome of a business doing good business is sustained, healthy profitability. And that's the evidence that we really see coming through in all of this research into impact investing. It's a place where we can just pause very, very quickly and emphasize the important distinction between responsible investing, sustainable investing, and impact investing. There are subtle but important differences between those terms. And a sustainable says I can keep doing what I've been doing. Socially responsible says even if this isn't profitable financially, it will give the sense of or have the evidence of doing good. And I'm using air commas in putting it around that doing good. Whereas impact investing in its most robust form is going to be all of those things. It is going to be sustainable. It is going to be inclusive. It is going to be healthy and viable for the business, the capital allocator. It's going to look after jobs all the way through the corporation, from C-suite through to, bad choice of term, coalface. And it's going to have impact on the communities that the businesses is operating in. Let me rush to the example that your question reminds me of, and it's the business Quicken Loans, which is operating in Detroit, Michigan. And it sets itself up as an online mortgage originator. So Quicken Loans has no physical bank branches, but gives you home loans.
Yes.
Quicken Loans was one of the first businesses to start digging into data, into customer data, so that they could engage with customers and not hunt customers down once they went into default or got behind on payments. But the moment they saw a bump in payment data or a blip in behavior, they would engage the customer in a relationship and ask them, what's going on? We've seen something happening in your payment record. How can we work with you? I mean, it just changes the nature of the relationship, the purpose of the business, the behavior of the customer. The implication for Quicken Loans' non-performing loan record is it collapsed, which is exactly what you want NPLs to do. And I think that that's a great example. More recently, Quicken Loans extended their lending behavior from home loans into corporate lending, with the undertaking that they would make a loan to you as a corporate if you relocated your head office to Detroit. And that starts to then build the economic system and the structure around your business and build your business into that community. And it really makes the point that company and community don't exist side by side. They coexist.
100%. Adrian, I wanted to introduce one more concept here that I think we've spoken about, but we haven't named, and that's innovation. In order for us to turn from the direction of travel, from seeing the change in perspective and saying, how do we tackle this, to open ourselves up to a different paradigm rather than strict shareholder capitalism, we need the tools. We need to be able to measure differently. We need to be able to make decisions differently that then result in, for example, the kind of innovation you've spoken about now, the use of data, the ability to risk, to put a price on risk of investing in a particular community and how that changes. And suddenly something that may have looked to you as being of high risk suddenly could look differently once it's been put into the context of that ecosystem. So maybe talk to us a little bit about the kinds of innovations that we're seeing, and in some cases even practicing with organizations that help teams to not only recognize that there needs to be a different kind of thinking, but become more empowered in practicing it in their own local context.
Project that we've been involved with for the last 10 years or more has been surveying the behavior of corporations or the executive teams of corporations and what those outcomes produce. The data, the study covers 5,000 global corporations over 10 years and 1,000 South African listed companies over 20 years. The evidence is convincing, and it suggests that there's a number of attributes or aspects that really stand out. And perhaps we can come to some company examples. Let me first give you the standout features. The first is that innovation is not necessarily a grand leap into a brand new frontier, that innovation often tends to be iterative, that it is a behavior of small steps fail quickly. And that's not about celebrating the failure, but that the failure gives you, it shows you which doors are shut or which avenues aren't going to work. So small steps fail quickly, get up, step again. A strategic term for this would be rapid prototyping. Mm. That's the first point, that innovation is not getting a rocket to the moon necessarily. It might be painting the fins of the rocket a slightly different color or making them out of a different fabric. That it can be innovative. The second is that innovation happens at every level of the firm. And that innovation can be at the C-suite, that we're going into a new industry, through to innovation I've used the term before, I'll use it again, at the coalface, where we're going to change a way that we do something, how we greet a client, that we have a person at the front door of our retail business smiling and welcoming a person in, that we instill a coalface culture that nothing is ever good enough, that we will constantly work to improve and enhance. But that's the second attribute, that innovation is right through the enterprise. I think a third aspect of innovation is that It's often imagined that innovation is some idea that a person has at a breakaway session, or you know, in a brainstorming, or in a lab somewhere, you know, offsite or a sandpit. And that's not to take away the fact that that is a place that real innovation does happen. But what is striking again and again is that innovation is fed by information that flows from the bottom of the organization or the base of the organization to the leadership. And so that leadership is acting under intelligence or data that is turned into intelligence, as opposed to, you know, hey, I've got an idea. Why don't we move into some market? I'm being very unkind, you know, to execs here. I'm not suggesting for one moment that's the, you know, that's the corporate behavior. I'm using, sweeping suggestions. But that innovation can be fed and informed by bottom-up flows of data. And so, you know, we refer to these as bottom-up organizations. And perhaps the fourth aspect of innovation that is very often intimidating is the fear that, you know, if we get this wrong, we're going to get left behind or we're out of business. Well, if you've got the first thing right, that innovation is iterative, that you're constantly trying, that you're always working on something new, you'll recognize that innovation is a moving roadway. I changed my word there. I was going to say a treadmill, but a treadmill just sounds like it never, ever gets you anywhere. Rather, innovation is a moving roadway. You know, the road underneath you moves. You can wander alongside it. You can step off for a while. You can step back on. You can speed it up. You can slow it down, but it never stops. The second is your journey is being fed and informed by data that becomes knowledge, and that data comes from customers, warehouses, pit operations, through to the C-suite. Innovation doesn't have to be grand. It can be, you know, modest endeavors, very small shifts or changes in behavior. And the fourth, somewhat related, is that innovation doesn't have to be a massive big ticket item. That innovation can often be a small step, that it's not necessarily grand strategy. And that again and again, what we find is that the businesses that do best are those that have got into the industry of just constantly refreshing, reviewing, revising, and those challenges to themselves, where they are mindful and reflective and determined, make them perennial innovators. Honda is one of the best examples, the Japanese motor business. Honda is one of the best examples of that.
Now, Adrian, maybe one aspect as I was listening to you that I just wanted perhaps to add or to layer onto this is, I guess as they become more innovative, as this becomes part of the culture of the organizations, of the organization, they, I guess from everything we've seen, they are more difficult to define anymore. They are less predictable to their competitors, because to someone sitting on the outside, it is more difficult to decipher what their next move is going to be. This becomes a complex self-reinforcing system of information flows, where if you're not part of that ecosystem, it's very difficult to replicate. It's very difficult to say, well, we can catch up to those. By the time you attempt to get to where they were, they've continued to evolve. So I guess that's one more, I guess, distinguishing factor that we've seen from this side. Adrian, I just want to talk a little bit about, in that context, about what we measure. Because I'm very conscious that for many years, our measurement system has very much been shaped around and molded into what is shareholder capitalism. Whether, you know, the good old budgeting system that increasingly looks archaic and out of touch with the kind of environment in which we are trying to get clarity of the numbers here, to performance management systems, which again are becoming increasingly disconnected from the empowered thinking teams within organizations that relish the opportunity to go and do something new, right down to how we measure investments and what we apply capital to. So maybe perhaps talk to us a little bit about if we become this more innovative organization, if we become this difficult to decode, more unique organization, difficult to emulate, how does the measurement system change?
So measuring performance, measuring outcomes, can ultimately be evidenced by the performance of companies. The suggestion being that capital will eventually be allocated to businesses, or ultimately will be allocated to businesses that are priced for successful and sustainable performance. And over a 30-year period, if you look at what we could call low sustainability businesses versus high sustainability businesses, low sustainability businesses produce 15 times start money. You put a dollar in 1990, in 2020, over the 30 years, you get 15 times money. If you go into high sustainability businesses, your $1 doesn't become $15, it becomes $30. That's a good outcome. For employees, for shareholders, for investors, for owners, for executives. At the same time, it is the high sustainability businesses that are achieving this 30 times start capital, which means by inference, by implication, the impacts, the measurements that we can conduct on society, communities, country at large, must be good also. And that's what John Nash of game theory fame would call a win-win outcome. And that's exactly the point. Your question is, how do we measure that? And that's a project that we've been involved with through the business school with one of our impact investors, that they endeavored to answer exactly that question. How do we know that we are doing good? Because when it comes to measuring impact, it can very often turn into storytelling. A couple of glossy photographs, some nice sidebar stories about building an education facility or perhaps a healthcare facility. And what you haven't truly assessed is the genuine impact. And to be a little bit, I'm trying to find the right term here to forgive the example I give, to be uncharitable. You could take, you could show a photograph of, we handed out 1,000 smartphones in this community. We gave people free data and look at the 1,000 phones and look at all of the online activity. With people accessing free data. And this is not about data providers, and it's not about mobile phones, it's about human behavior and our measurement. And what these people could be doing is they could be watching mindless cartoons. They could be online gaming. They could be playing online bingo for all we know. And so that's the point of the measurement, is it needs to go deep into the behaviors and the architecture and get out of the superficial and the anecdotes. The impact framework that we built for our client has four main questions that sit resident in measuring the performance, to go to your question. The first is the capital contribution. And here, we distinguish between brownfields and greenfields. If you are allocating capital to an existing enterprise, to an existing activity, brownfields investment, then your impact can't count the same as if you were greenfields investing. So greenfields capital necessarily has potentially much, much higher impact. And of course, brownfields capital, if it is profitable and then retains those profits and reinvests those profits, that is beyond replacement capital. That's new investment. So that brownfields capital can actually produce greenfields investment. So that's a first metric. A second is we don't have to invent the wheel here, or the wheel has been invented, and it takes the form of SDGs. And the United Nations SDGs is comprehensive. It's relatively, it is objective. It's universally regarded and respected, and it is an excellent basis for measuring impact. So you can map your activities and your behaviors to the SDGs. The third way in which we can measure impact is to realize that, or recognize that, if you make an allocation of capital, if you build a data warehouse in South Sudan, it's going to have far higher impact than if you build it in South Korea. So location, location, location. That the same capital, the same enterprise, the same business built in different communities, different countries, different locations will necessarily have different impact. And so we can add the adjective here to call this measured impact, as opposed to just impact. And then the fourth aspect of measuring performance is ultimately financial. And here we ask, what is the cost of capital to the business, and what is the return on invested capital? And if the cost of if the return on invested capital is above the cost of capital, then not only is your business sufficiently profitable, but it is also financially sustainable and ultimately doing the thing that shareholders are rewarding you for, and that is producing an elevated return on invested capital over the cost of capital. That is having good impact, positive outcomes in the countries and communities that it's working in. And I think that this is a very neat way and a robust way of measuring impact.
Hmm. Adrian, one of the things that that certainly stood up for me when I look at the model is, you know, good decision making. One of the attributes of good decision making is the diversity of views of perspective that you bring in. If everyone think the same or think along the same paradigm, you're going to get very predictable decisions. If we want to expand that, if we want to introduce more diversity, you're more likely to get, I guess, in a way, more robust, but also more open-ended options that come up, the less predictable ones. And in that light, the four criteria, or the four perspectives that you've shared with us, I guess one of the things that I'm seeing is it enables people who are not, necessarily the investment professionals in the room to still be very involved, because you talk about location, you speak about the impact of different geographies. You speak about, you know, more than one way to affect an investment. You speak about brownfields versus greenfields. So for me, it's actually an opportunity for leadership teams to bring the whole of themselves and every member of the team into the decision. It's no more us looking at the person in the room who would make sure the photos are taken and the cell phones are at the right angle and a good story gets published. if I had to be quite facetious about this, but
So yeah. You know what your comment reminds me of is Rutger Bregman's most recent work called Humankind. In which he writes about the goodness and wholesomeness of humanity, and hence humankind. But Rutger Bregman, the reference that you remind me of, or the work that you remind me of in his research, talks about participatory budgeting, And participatory budgeting happens where communities are involved in municipal budgets. And in his book, Humankind, I'm paraphrasing, but he talks about observations made by people who have attended municipal budgets and taken part in the process. And their responses and their feedback are, I had no idea that we had the ability to produce outcomes that are so much more meaningful by being involved in the process. And one of the throwaway quotes goes something like, I had no idea that being part of government could be so exciting and so meaningful. and that's exactly what, you know, this impact framework facilitates. I think you've nailed it, you know, right on the head, is that it is broad-based. It takes us from that narrow shareholder capitalism to much, much wider stakeholder participation.
Adrian, when we have conversations with leadership teams that still feel very much in the throes of shareholder capitalism, that are wondering, how do I get there? How do I become more innovative in the kind of, in our case, impact measurement that could be affected by our organization? What are some of the lessons or observations you want to share with them for those who are starting the journey, who know that there is a better way, a more participatory way of doing this? What would you share with them?
I think three things. The first thing that I would share with them is my, perhaps I can cheekily suggest my email address, because you know, that's not a sales trip. That's there is so much data on this that you can look at that evidences these arguments. And when you're looking at that evidence, it is very hard to deny or refute the reality that this type of inclusive, collaborative behavior is this is why that word belongs here. It is impactful, and it is meaningful. It is sustainable. It is rewarding on so many levels. It can really give purpose to the corporation, to the enterprise, and to the activities and operations of the business. But I think, you know, that reaches across so many fronts. From your shareholders will be delighted, your employees will be delighted, the communities, your customers will be delighted. I mean, it really is wide-ranging and far-reaching. The second is, you know, I made the point about innovation earlier, is I don't think you can go to sleep. You know, if we've had a fantastic podcast conversation here, then people should be scrambling, you know, for working out after this. Well, how do I become that type of corporation? How do I rebuild myself? It's not done overnight. It is a journey. And much like the earlier observations about innovation, they are many, many steps that take you down that road. It's not one great leap that rebirths you tomorrow as a different type of enterprise. But start somewhere, and that starting somewhere gets you on that journey. And you know, perhaps the third recognition is, or the third argument or evidence. I might be corrupting your question, but it's, you need buy-in, that you can't do this without collective buy-in. And the best way to get that buy-in is, I'll take us back to my earlier point about the evidence is there. So if it's shareholders that you're trying to convince, let's show them the evidence on 30 times capital versus 15 times capital. If it's employees that you're trying to convince, because you're going to drop one type of business practice and that might lead to job losses, these can be looked after and protected by transitioning and transforming in what we could call a just transformation or a just transition process. You know, so this will be, if it is successful and sustainable, it will be inclusive at so many levels, embracing what in many environments are actually competing mindsets or competing agendas. can actually be melded and merged to collaborative and combined agendas.
Wonderful. I mean, it's so insightful and kind of reminds me one of the practitioners of impact investing, who's the CEO of a venture capital fund by the name of JVP. He said it so nicely, very similar to what you were describing, is when they started their journey, they felt they were small. They were just starting out, and they were much bigger, smarter, more competent players. And they just applied themselves, and they found their own ways, and they're all small innovations. And at one point, he said, you know, as we were kind of pedaling uphill, using a cycling analogy, he said, found that everyone else have dropped off, that we've become bigger, more capable, more confident, and they're doing wonderful things all over the world in the field of impact investing. It's remarkable to see from very humble beginnings how organizations can find their way into this form of innovation, this form of looking and applying themselves differently beyond shareholder capitalism. Adrian, thank you very much for the conversation. Insightful as ever.
Thank you, Sal.
Hidden Growth Champions, the podcast. Join us next time for more business news, views, and insights from across the globe.